Welcome back in to the ninth edition of the Fifth Down Podcast. I am your host, Mike Fiella. We have a jam-packed show for you all tonight. I am joined in first and second down by Arizona State Senior Associate Athletic Director Gene Boyd to discuss all things compliance and recruiting. That news is especially pertinent considering all of these scandals that have happened throughout the NCAA landscape, including the big news this week with the NCAA investigation being botched regarding the University of Miami. Also discuss what were some of the key matchups, some of the key things to look on, during the BCS National Championship game with ESPN.com Notre Dame blogger Matt Fortuna coming back for his second tour of duty in the fifth down. In third down, I'll give you my take on the Manti Te'o situation. What does that mean in terms of his football draft stock moving forward? In fourth down, I give you my take on the NFL. We will save the Super Bowl predictions for next week's show. I give you my take in fourth down on the New York Jets, how they just happen to be the gift that keeps on giving. Without further ado, let's hop in to first down. Into first down now, we are joined by ESPN.com Notre Dame blogger for the second time this season, Matt Fortuna. Matt, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no. Thanks for coming on the show, Matt. We brought Matt on to discuss, obviously, the Notre Dame Fighting Irish being in the BCS National Championship game against Alabama. But first, before we get to the National Championship game, Matt, the big buzz in the college football world was the Heisman Trophy this past week. Manti Te'o was a finalist, lost to Texas A&M quarterback Johnny Manziel. What were your expectations for Te'o in terms of the Heisman? Did you think he would win, or is that just very difficult for a defensive player, especially a guy like Te'o who had a great year?
No, I was surprised and really impressed that he got as close as he did, and that's not an indictment of his play or anyone's play or anything of that sort. Just given the history of voters' tendencies, their reluctance to really boost an exclusively defensive player up on that platform, I was surprised that Te'o got as close as he did. I think there's no shame in what he did. He won 6 national awards earlier in the week. He won a 7th with the Law Trophy Sunday night. No other player in the history of college football has done that. Charles Woodson at 5 in 1997. So I don't think any less of him after him losing the Heisman Trophy, and I'm impressed that he got that far.
Yeah, absolutely, especially in the new age of college football with the spread formations and the quarterbacks running. Manziel had a great year as well, over 4,600 yards. I think he broke Cam Newton and Tim Tebow's record for most yards ever accumulated by a quarterback in the SEC. But there's no shame for Manti Te'o with the 7 interceptions, the 1.5 sacks, the 4 pass defenses, and being the leader of the undefeated number one ranked team in the country. Te'o clearly projects to the next level as a great linebacker and has been phenomenal this entire season. But Matt, as we looked towards the BCS National Championship game, the Irish face the Crimson Tide of Alabama. Clearly, they are not a team to be taken lightly. They are first in points against the nation, giving up only 8.2. They are just a defensive dominant team. What can we expect from the Irish against a defense as talented as Alabama's?
It'll be interesting to see. They obviously have a young quarterback, a redshirt freshman, and Everett Golson, who seemed to be hitting his stride as the season progressed. He was playing his best ball at the end of the season. That's what you like to see out of young guys. I'm interested to see how he fares against this defense. He's obviously learned a lot more in the playbook over the course of the season. He's been running the ball a lot more. He's not been fazed by the bright lights. He played great on the night at Oklahoma and at USC. So I think mentally he'll be there just fine. But this Alabama defense, like you said, is a whole other level of test for this team.
Yeah, Golson on the season, he has 161 completions and 282 attempts, 2,135 yards, 11 touchdowns, 5 interceptions. Not eye-popping passing numbers, but he has played better as the season has progressed. Running the football, he has 305 yards and 5 touchdowns. So clearly he's a dual-threat guy, really poses problems for Alabama. I would like to know, what is going on in the Irish backfield? Sierre Wood came into the season as the starter, but it seems down the stretch it has been Theo Riddick that has gotten more of the burn at the running back spot. It seemed to me that switch happened after the Oklahoma game where Riddick had 18 carries, Wood had 7. What is going on with the Irish backfield?
Well, Wood was suspended the first two games of the season. He had 1,100 yards last season, was expected to be the number one guy. I think as you saw the offense develop a bit in the spring and in camp, it turned into a more of a 1A, 1B dynamic with Theo Riddick. Riddick is a guy who came as a running back, switched to receiver the last two seasons, and this season they made assistant coach Tony Alford in charge of the running backs and slot receivers. So they're asking for a little bit more out of the running backs this year. And with that new dynamic, Riddick really seems to fit it well given his pass duties as a slot receiver. I think he's a better pass catcher. He's obviously more of a threat to catch the ball out of the backfield. And I think that's earned him the bulk of the carries here down the stretch. He's impressed me between the tackles as well. Against USC, he just would not go down on first contact. But again, Wood is, I think, a bit of a faster guy, a bit more of an open field guy. He's obviously another good complementary piece in that backfield, and they've got a great two-headed monster back there in the backfield.
Yeah, to your point, Theo Riddick against USC had the 20 carries, 146 yards. He had one touchdown, and he was just dominant. It seemed every single time the Irish needed a couple yards to convert a first down or make it a third and manageable, Riddick was the guy. He was extremely difficult for the Trojans to stop down the stretch. For the Irish, clearly Alabama, so dominant against stopping the run. What do we expect for them going forward, the Irish running game?
Good question. I'm looking at both sides of that. Obviously, Alabama, too, ran for 350 yards against Georgia in the SEC title game, and that's a very good Georgia defense. I think the way Alabama was able to impose its will, despite losing by 10, 11 points in the second half, they did not get away from their bread and butter, and I think that just shows the faith and the endurance that offensive line really has. And this is a Notre Dame rush defense that, like Alabama's, has been phenomenal all season long. So it should be an interesting scenario. It's toughness against toughness in this matchup, the two best scoring defenses in the nation. I think it's going to be a close game either way, but I think whichever defense shows the biggest cracks early is probably going to be a team that loses.
Obviously, A.J. McCarron has been here for the Crimson Tide. He has to face against Manti Te'o on the defense, audible versus audible, almost a game of wits between the two of them. Is there anything the Irish can do, or what should the Irish do, to rattle McCarron a little bit? Because they're going to need a break or two, you would think, especially with Alabama coming off such a big win.
Yeah, you know, the biggest matchup is probably Alabama's offensive line against Notre Dame's pass rush. Alabama's offensive line has been near invincible all season long. It's been kind of like an immovable object. They've got three All-Americans on there. Notre Dame's pass rush has been phenomenal. They've been great at stopping the run. It'll be interesting to see the plan of attack that Alabama does take against Georgia in the SEC title game. It was kind of just run, run, run. Last year in the national title game against LSU, it was more, let's let McCarron open things up on first and second down. So I've not seen McCarron really rattled so far in the backfield. I think that's a testament to his offensive line. I'm not sure how he would react to a couple of hits, but Notre Dame can get back there, try to hit him early. It could create an interesting dynamic throughout the course of the game.
That's a good point. Alabama, to your point, 51 carries, 350 yards, three touchdowns, gashed Georgia. And Notre Dame will have to stop that run to a point. I mean, it'll be difficult, obviously, to stop Alabama to no yards, but or very little, I should say. But I would think they're going to have to maybe make them a little bit more one-dimensional, because when Alabama's running the football like they have been, it's very difficult to stop. If I tell you this player has to play well against Alabama for Notre Dame to win, that player is?
On defense, I'm going to say Lewis Nix. I think he's going to play well regardless. He's been arguably their best defensive player all season long, but he's got the biggest assignment in going up against All-American center Barrett Jones. So that's going to dictate a lot of how this matchup goes when Alabama has the ball. So I think if Nix can get good push off the point of attack, it can force some people open on the outside to get to McCarron. That's going to make things a lot easier for Notre Dame's defense in general.
On offense, Notre Dame needs a big game from
Everett Golson. You know, everything revolves around him. He's been yanked more than twice. He's yanked two of the first four games earlier this season, and again against Pitt earlier this season. All those games had come at home. Again, he has not been flustered on the road. He seems to be pretty confident away from the comforts of home. But everything just revolves around him, whether it's running the ball, throwing the ball, getting everyone on the same page, shedding protections with the offensive line. It all comes back to the man under center.
for Everett Golson. His best friend all season has been tight end Tyler Eifert. Eifert against the Trojans had 4 catches for 69 yards, a long of 36. Do we expect a big game here from Eifert, or is that too early to tell? Is that something kind of we're just going to figure out on game day?
Yeah, I think we'll figure it out on game day. He went through a 2 or 3 week stretch earlier this season where he did not catch a pass, and that's pretty out of characteristic for a guy who's been this team's best receiver, even though he's a tight end. He's broken pretty much every Notre Dame tight end record there is among receivers. He's been great with Tommy Reese. That was his guy last year when he had a record-breaking season, and a majority of his big games came with Reese under center even this year. I think Golson develops a better rapport with him down the stretch of the course of the season. You mentioned the USC game. I think that was a great example. I'm interested to see how Alabama defends this guy, because I haven't seen too many tight ends of his caliber in the SEC.
Absolutely. Eifert is a guy that has tremendous hands. He can run and the great leaping ability. Golson would love to get him going, take some pressure off of Riddick and Wood in the backfield. For a game that has defenses that are just great, I mean, frankly, Alabama and Notre Dame's defenses have been fantastic all season. Occasionally, other than turnovers, it is the special teams that, whether it's a big return, a missed field goal, a muffed punt, what do we expect from the Irish special teams? That might be an area where they may be able to even the playing field, per se.
Nowhere. In short, they've been pretty horrendous on special teams going 2 years in a row. Now, last year, at least, George Atkinson III had returned a pair of kickoffs for scores. He has not been as effective this season, as most kick returners haven't, given the new rules. But punt return, they just have not been able to get anything going with true freshman Devontae Neal back there. I think he has potential playmaking skills to become a game changer, but he just has not gotten the protection and the necessary space to create and improvise so far this season. They've not been great on special teams all season long. It's something I think they need to work harder on preventing a big play more than anything, and just try not to screw anything up or turn the ball over on their end.
Yeah, sometimes that's a challenge within itself, especially in the BCS National Championship game. Occasionally we see players try too hard press. It happens even in the NFL. We saw it this past weekend with Patrick Peterson. The Cardinals team needs a play, muffs a punt right by his own end zone. So that is a difficult task in itself, just to not mess it up. At the end of the day, ultimately, the winner of the National Championship game probably will be determined by which offense can make the other defense budge a little bit. Who do you see as the winner? What are some of the things that you see are critical that we haven't already mentioned?
It's too close right now. Excuse me, too far right now for me to predict it. I've been going back and forth in the however many days since it's been announced. They're just so evenly matched on both sides of the ball. You know, I mean, Alabama, despite the history and the gauntlet they went through in the SEC, and obviously the Vegas line favoring them, I don't think this team is invincible. I'd argue that it's not as talented as some of Nick Saban's past championship teams. So I definitely think they're beatable. Notre Dame is too. I mean, obviously they had their number of close calls earlier this season against inferior opponents. They seem to play down and up to their competition. I think the secondaries in both defenses could have a couple of holes that the other offenses are going to have to exploit. But neither offense has really blown me away, at least through the air, so far this season. So a lot of matchups within the matchup that I'm looking forward to, that being one of them. It should be a close, great game either way, though.
That's true. I mean, the Irish struggled with Pittsburgh at home. The triple overtime, the missed field goal by Pitt, when it looked like Notre Dame's undefeated season was over. They're able to get a little bit of luck from the Irish there, come up with the win. But the week before, they play Oklahoma in Norman and played tremendous. So sometimes maybe it seems the Notre Dame team a little Jekyll and Hyde, even though they, for the most part, have taken care of business, obviously 12-0. The national championship game a couple weeks out. But Matt, I'd like to get your opinion on something. You cover the college football landscape. The BCS obviously makes a lot of people flustered. Ohio State this season undefeated, but not bowl eligible. A lot of people have kind of debated, kicked around the topic. What would have happened if Ohio State was eligible? If they were bowl eligible, do you think we would still see Notre Dame and Alabama, or would Ohio State throw a wrench in that plan?
I don't know for sure. I would guess, given history, given the relatively down play of the Big Ten this season, and the SEC's recent history, and the fact that Alabama had a 13th game against a great opponent that they defeated, I would guess Alabama gets the lift. I don't have any conclusive data in front of me right now that says that. I just have a hard time seeing an undefeated Big Ten team leaping the SEC champion in this day and age, given all that has happened with the SEC the last six seasons.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Either way, though, I think it would be a good game, whether it was Notre Dame, Alabama, Alabama, Ohio State, or Notre Dame, Ohio State. All three teams are a cut above the rest. Finally, what does this season mean for Notre Dame going forward, separate from the fact that they are 12-0 playing the national championship? Does this finally mean that Notre Dame is Notre Dame again, that Notre Dame is back, or is this not a blip on the radar, an anomaly, but does this not mean that they are back?
No, they're back, and I think they're here to stay. I'm not sure if they're going to be competing for a national championship or stay year in and year out and run the table the way Alabama almost has every single season, but I do think they'll be a perennial BCS bowl contender year in and year out. Their recruiting class right now, they just got a five-star running back in Greg Bryant. They're up to number three on ESPN's recruiting rankings. They return a lot of talent to this team next season. Obviously, Manti Te'o will be graduating, but there are plenty of good linebackers coming up in this class, Jalen Smith, Alex Anzalone, to name a few. This is what they've been building toward. You know, they have those they've gone to SEC country, if you will, and gotten those big, game-changing defensive players. They have a young quarterback who, you forget, as much as you want to criticize Everett Bolson, he has upwards of 40 career starts remaining, and he's got Gunnar Keel behind him as well. So there's definitely talent there. The coaching staff has done a much better job of developing them than the previous regime, and I think Notre Dame is here to stay.
Everett Bolson is only going to get better, we would think, anyway. And with all the talent that Notre Dame has coming in, I mean, Brian Kelly's done a great job restocking the cupboard after Charlie Weiss's era, I should say, to leave it that way. Matt, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Hey, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Into second down now, I am joined by Senior Associate Athletic Director at Arizona State, former Sun Devil football player and New England Patriot, Gene Boyd. Gene, how are you?
Michael, it's good. I'm doing well, and it's good to be with you this evening.
All right, Gene, thanks a lot for taking the time to come on the show. Gene, for all of you listeners out there, Gene deals with athlete development, helping make the right decisions in terms of when to go pro, if not to go pro, and just maneuver college life as an athlete. I guess my first question would be, Gene, we all see college players every week on the field playing in all different sports, but we don't really understand kind of what goes into that. Explain, what's a typical day like for an athlete at any school?
Sure. There's a lot of variance in responding to that question. The student athletes, depending on the sport that they participate in, have varying practice schedules, you know, depending on whether they're in season or out of season. If we take, for example, ASU football, our coaching staff chooses to practice in the mornings. And so, for example, a typical Tuesday would start with a student athlete going to meetings with the football coaching staff at 7 a.m. They'd be in some type of meeting, whether it be team, position, special teams, until probably about 8:45. They'd then go out to the practice field, and practice would run from probably anywhere between 9 to 11:30, 11:45 or so. After they come off the field, they tram back in, they eat together. Any type of physical therapy or injury maintenance or preventive maintenance that would need to be done would happen then. And then their academic day would start shortly thereafter, probably around, you know, 1 o'clock or so. 1 to maybe 4 o'clock, 4:30 would be class attendance, and they'd come back over for a structured study time that might go from 5 o'clock to 6:30, if you will. So pretty much from top to bottom, 7 a.m. to about 6:30, almost 7 p.m., they're engaged in some type of structured, organized facet of their either football or academic experience. On the flip side, if you took our basketball team, those fellas practice in the afternoon, and so kind of would flip the order of things, and they would start out in the morning in maybe a structured study table, then off to class, then practice after that, and then the training and all that stuff after practice. So just kind of depending on the way that the structure is set up, part of the coaches' viewpoint on when they want to get practice done and all, you're really looking at between academics and their sport, probably a 12-hour day at least.
Obviously, it's a full-time job to be a student. Additionally, it's a full-time job to be a football player or a basketball player or a gymnast, whatever you name the sport. Obviously, it's a huge commitment. When you have to juggle so many different things and wear so many different hats, when a student or a player, they seem to get bogged down academically, what are some of the things that you guys can provide, you guys meaning the academic institution and the coaching staff, the athletic department, to make sure that players are fulfilling their playing and scholastic obligations?
Sure, good question. As you can imagine, the backgrounds of the individual student athletes across all sports vary greatly. As we expressed, that their practice schedules also vary. Student athletes come from all walks of life. Some of them are very organized people, individuals who've been high achievers in the classroom, in their sport, in other areas of their life since they were a young child, and in others who may not be as organized, may not be as structurally sound. And so what you see is that depending on how successful they've been at organization, prioritizing and making good decisions about use of time in their upbringing, that's kind of what they come to college with. And so those who have been preconditioned and predisposed to be high achievers and highly organized, usually without much support, figure out how to make it all fit together and do things in a timely manner, get assistance, for example, with tutoring if and when they needed it, and are pretty successful from day one. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, you find individuals who don't have that skill set, who are going to struggle mightily. And so what we do is we evaluate who they are and what their background is and what their skill set is entering college, and then we apply a system of support on an individual level based on what their profile looks like. So one young person on a given team, let's say on our softball team, our national champion softball team 2 years ago, as a freshman might have 6 hours of structured study where we're just making sure that they have a place, a quiet place to get their work done and being, you know, structured and organized. Whereas they may be someone on that same team who may have 10 hours of structured study, have a tutor for every class, and have an academic mentor, which is someone who works through organization, prioritization, et cetera, on a daily basis as well. So it can look very different even in the same class academically. A lot of it depends on their background and what they come to college with.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. Regardless of whether you're an athlete or you're just a full-time student, there are tons of people at Arizona State, students with different academic levels, different strengths, different weaknesses. It does make a lot of sense. We've all heard of the scandals, right, of players getting improper benefits and the NCAA cracking down on programs. Ohio State and USC would be examples. What are some of the things that you guys in the athletic department do to ensure that those things don't happen?
Yeah, there is a pretty massive education component that not only includes the student-athletes, but also the parents of student-athletes, donors and boosters, individuals who support the athletic program, faculty members. I mean, anyone who comes into contact with the student-athlete experience has some type of educational component that they are connected to one way or another. So that you know, that's a big preventative piece, is educating people on what they can and can't do. For example, faculty members that might even help us in recruiting, they receive some information on, you know, what may or may not be appropriate or permissible. For example, if they were going to have a meeting with a prospect who was a student athlete that we were trying to recruit to come to ASU, and they went to lunch with that prospect, they would not be permitted to pay for that lunch. So even things like that, you know, you have to, on the front end, make sure that people understand, you know, what the rules say. And then as things go along, you know, there's a lot more intensive education that's done with the student athletes in particular. You know, and some of the cases that you mentioned, we of course would print those out or pull a video down off of, you know, ESPN.com or wherever we could find the material, and we would deliver that to them. We would have them read that, or we would give them a scenario and ask them how they would respond to it and use it as a teaching tool. The NCAA has a pretty thick rule book, well chronicled that's the case.
Right.
And so there's a lot of things that you need to be aware of and be proactive in educating about.
Arizona State recruits players. Obviously, they are looking for the best players, talent-wise, on the field that they could get possible. Where do you draw the line in terms of maybe this is a great player, talent-wise, a five-star recruit or maybe a number one or number two in his class at that position, but he might not be a great fit? How does an athletic department balance getting the right players versus just the most talented players?
Yeah, I think you actually used the right word. It's about fit. Number one, the character of the individuals that we are recruiting and looking at as being prospects to come and be a Sun Devil is critically important. Understanding, you know, who's in their life and who has influenced them. And that's not to say that there aren't young people out there who may have had a difficult upbringing, even may have been foster children, who may have figured out a way to stay on the right path and to be positive and constructive in their life. You know, so there's no labeling or no category by which we would rule someone out.
Mm-hmm.
It's about forming a relationship with that young person and understanding who are the positive influences in their life and measuring what we think they are capable of molding and shaping themselves into in an environment like the collegiate, you know, four-year environment. You know, so there's not a template per se. You know, you hear horror stories about kids who could barely read or write and somehow matriculate into college because maybe someone in their high school career helped them too much.
And, right.
You know, once they get on campus, they're not able to do the work, and then they get frustrated, and then they act out, and all those types of things. And if you're running a solid program, and if you're doing your homework the right way, you know that you should be able to avoid that type of situation,
right.
Regardless of how athletically gifted a student athlete might be. They do need to be a good fit, and you do need to make sure that they're capable of not only doing the academic part, but socially conducting themselves in a manner that, you know, advances your program and makes the university look good.
Absolutely. Sports fans everywhere can remember, of course, Maurice Claret from Ohio State. I want to say maybe 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 years ago now, leaving early and finding himself in a lot of off-the-field trouble. Maybe that wasn't the right fit, maybe unfair to say. When you or Coach Graham or whoever, we're talking about football, could be any sport, when a school comes in to recruit a kid, what are some of the key non-football aspects? Character, hard work, where they come from, or are we missing something?
No, I mean, it's the things that you would tend to point to. Character, decision-making. You know, typically when a coach goes onto a high school campus, which almost all sports coaches do that, I mean, they're going to talk to the principal, they're going to talk to the guidance counselor in addition to the coach and find out information about how that student conducts themselves. Almost every sport, there are home visits where the coach goes out recruiting and we're going to the student-athletes or the prospect's home and, you know, meet the family,
right,
and understand what the family's values are. I think values are really important. I think identity is important. How does a young person identify themselves? Do they see themselves as someone who's well-rounded and who can achieve academically just as they can in the field of play? or do they see themselves as a minor leaguer who is going to go to the minor league of college football, basketball,
right.
baseball, women's basketball, and then get to the, you know, the professional ranks as soon as possible? Those are some of the deeper things that they would look at.
When you have a recruit that is highly talented, you know, the football team, the basketball team, like James Harden a couple years ago, ASU has tons of NFL players in the league. How do you advise a student athlete to make the right decision? Obviously, they have their family or their friends or outside forces all telling them this is their chance, they're going to be a pro. But obviously, not everyone can be a pro. It has a lot to do with the time and place, when you're going, how many viable players at your position are in your draft class. How do you talk to a kid that is urging or trying very hard to go pro or is leading in that direction, but it might not be the right fit for him? How do you guys try to change his mind?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very, very personal decision. If we all looked at the purpose of college is to advance yourself from a career standpoint, to give yourself an opportunity to be an achiever in life, you know, and to have a good life and start a family if that's what you want to do. So, you know, college was designed to get people ahead and separate, you know, individuals from an educational standpoint, from a expertise standpoint.
Right.
You know, from the masses and elevate them and so forth. So, you know, on an individual level, if you have a young person who is amongst the best in the world, really, at their craft,
mm-hmm.
whether it be computer science, computer programming, engineering, football, dancing, and that individual is a junior in college and some corporate entity, some dance company, an NFL team is saying to them, hey, the very reason that you went to college to make a better way for yourself in your life, I've seen enough that I'm ready to invest in you right now.
Right.
That's a really difficult choice because, you know, in most industries, including the NFL, those who graduate from college earn more, right?
Right.
But if there's a special situation where, based on what you've shown thus far, you can go right now and do what you love and make a great living for yourself and your family and set yourself up for the rest of life, that's a really difficult thing to even, you know, be in a conversation with someone to try to dissuade them from doing that. So when it gets to that point, you know, the most important thing is to have all the facts.
Right.
What we see happen too often, and not necessarily at ASU, but just nationally, is that juniors in college in either baseball, basketball, football, or any other sport that has a professional opportunity afterwards are listening to all the wrong people, and they're not looking at the facts. Most of the professional leagues, take the NFL, for example, have bodies or boards, if you will, that will give you an evaluation and tell you exactly where you stand within their world, so to speak, as it relates to being a draftable player.
Right.
So if you're thinking about coming out as a junior, you can apply and you'll get a ranking or a rating of what your draft stock is. And if it comes back and says, you know, you're pretty much guaranteed to be a first-round draft pick, you know, how do you tell a young man, hey, man, you know, don't forego that now and stay in school? I mean, depends on what their values are, depends on what their family's values are, depends on how important earning their college degree is, depends on how close they are.
Absolutely.
To earning their degree. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. If there are situations where that draft analysis comes back and it says you're a free agent, then it's a pretty easy conversation to have
right.
to try to be persuasive, right?
Absolutely.
About whether or not they should, you know, take their chances and roll the dice, so to speak. That's a huge roll of the dice right there. So it's like buying 20 lottery tickets today, right, when there's a $500 million
absolutely, right.
lottery deal. So
one or two more here with Gene Boyd. Gene, this past year, Arizona State had a coaching change. In the constant world of recruiting, it's getting more competitive than ever in the Pac-12 with the addition of two more teams being on TV, having a national reach that they haven't had 50, 60 years ago. When you have a coaching change, how does an athletic department keep the recruits that they have and continue to recruit without a head coach right there to step in?
Yeah, I can give you an intimate, close and personal response to that. So a year ago at this time, when we were going through that coaching change, you know, obviously the head coach has been turned over, and there's really no guarantees either way with other folks on the staff. Some people move quickly on to other opportunities. Others may want to kind of bargain for a position on the new staff, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so what we saw happen last year was we had a couple of the men that were on Coach Erickson's staff who stayed on temporarily to help recruit, you know, in the hopes that they might be able to get a position with the new coaching staff. And, you know, if you think about it, the way the rules read, I think you can have seven people on the road at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had two guys who were sticking around to be a part of it, and that's it that we could that we had able to go out. So myself and another administrator were able to get a NCAA waiver, temporary clearance, to be able to go out and recruit. So it's kind of that that other duties as assigned,
right?
That you never know you signed up for. But in that moment, you know, we needed someone who understood football, understands what we're doing in football, understands what our commitment is to developing young men who play the sport of football, which obviously I lead that effort, to have someone like that be able to go out on the road, what was I think extremely helpful for us. And many of the young men that we had already committed, we were able to keep interested, you know, long enough until we got our new coaching staff hired, and many of those young men ended up being Sun Devils after all.
I would say, especially with Coach Graham, I think he did a great job coming in later in the process and keeping the football program, the recruiting class together. I think that was a great job by the university, the new coaching staff as a whole. It could have been extremely ugly. Finally, Gene, with Rich Rodriguez obviously taking the coaching job at Arizona, being in the Pac-12 so close to California, recruiting is harder than ever. What do you think the ASU victory over U of A means for the offseason? Is that a big bragging point between the two schools when you're talking to a potential recruit? Or is that media fodder and kind of just overblown?
Oh, man, it's so huge. I don't think you can overhype it. I don't think the media probably can even do justice to how important that victory is and what it means to our program right now. You mentioned, you know, the school down south and they're trying to build just like we are.
Absolutely.
And they're trying to build a sustained program that is a championship contender on a consistent basis. So when you have, two schools so close to one another in proximity, and, you know, you may have some of the same or similar selling points year one to beat them at the end and to ultimately, you know, as it relates to the conference and where we place in the conference, I mean, essentially we're tied for second place in the conference, and they're not.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, that's a leg up. And the fact that, you know, with the Pac-12 evolving the way that it has and the television opportunities for exposure, being on ESPN on the night after Thanksgiving, which is a big football day.
Absolutely.
And, you know, people watching that game, I mean, they saw not only exciting football, but they saw an absolutely determined effort by the Sun Devils, who were 10 points down going into the fourth quarter. I mean, that thing could have went the other way quick.
Yes.
If our guys were not wired the way they were, and if Coach Graham hadn't made the traction he had in terms of helping them understand what it really means to be a Sun Devil and what Sun Devil football is all about, I can't imagine another coach going into an institution where he's never played or never worked and that quickly coming to terms with and creating a strong understanding for what it means to be a Sun Devil.
Yes, absolutely.
And so, you know, that relentless effort that we saw, you know, playing with a chip on our shoulder at the end, and all those things are the things that have positioned us over many years where we are, and things I think he's only going to build on.
Do you think, obviously there's a stark contrast from the media, what they portray of Coach Erickson and Coach Graham, without obviously disparaging either, both are great coaches and have had success. Has there been a big difference from the Dennis Erickson-led Arizona State Sun Devils and the Todd Graham-led Devils?
Well, I think any time, you know, you have a coaching change and there are different philosophies, you know, both on and off the field, there's a big change. So that, you know, there's nothing controversial about that. I think that what Coach Graham understands and what I respect about what he's done upon his arrival is that, you know, in the 21st century, with all of the technology and recruiting and the way that kids are wired, I mean, you really have to have a systematic approach to building a program. And there's certain pillars that program is, or that foundation is built upon. One is certainly recruiting. And from day one, him and his staff were, I think, have been tireless in terms of getting out into the local community, the local high schools, and forming relationships there. And then also, of course, abroad in the different areas that we're recruiting in. I think another pillar is having a good connection with your alumni in the sport of football. And again, tireless effort that he displayed in building connections with the alumni, some of the things that he did, allowing for the former players to feel welcomed and to be in the tunnel pregame before the Sun Devils run out on the field and to have more access than they felt like they did before. He put up the history of Sun Devil football all throughout the corridors of the third floor, which is kind of the building in our, or I'm sorry, the floor in our building where football is housed. You know, a guy who played here can go up on the third floor and feel proud about the fact that he played at Arizona State University. Another pillar would be alumni relationships, you know, building rapport with individuals who support our program and individuals who went to ASU and who maybe are just on the edge of their seat waiting to support us, not only in attendance, but maybe financially, who want something to feel proud about. And I think that they saw a product on the field this year that they could be proud about, even in the games we lost. I think it's become well noted that, you know, we're a 40-some-yard field goal miss away from being in the Pac-12 championship game this week if we would have beat UCLA at the very end there.
Right.
So, you know, to be that close in a transition year of coaches, I think says a lot about those foundational elements that are being put in place. And, you know, now that the foundation is laid, it's time to build on top of.
Notre Dame this year is going to go play in the national championship game. It wasn't that long ago when Notre Dame didn't have the aura that it has now or it had in the past. It wasn't that long ago when people were saying, is Notre Dame ever going to come back? So you're right. Things can change very quickly, and clearly leadership at the front is what makes that go. Hey, thanks a lot for coming on the show today. I greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure. And, if there's any further conversations that we can have that will be of significance to those who listen, I'd be glad to be.
Into third down now, I would like to take another moment to thank ESPN.com Notre Dame blogger Matt Fortuna, in addition to Arizona State Senior Associate Athletic Director Gene Boyd for spending a few moments of their time with us. In third down now, I give you my take on Manti Te'o, the star middle linebacker from the University of Notre Dame. Te'o has become involved in some off-field issues surrounding the existence of his girlfriend, who allegedly died of cancer, who actually did not exist, Te'o claiming it was a hoax. But to me, that situation has been played out by media sources throughout the country. My take is, what does that situation mean for Manti Te'o on the field? Te'o, of course, was an extremely accomplished player, finishing second in the Heisman Trophy, the highest ever, by a strictly defense-only player. Of course, Charles Woodson of Michigan won it in 98, but he played both receiver, defensive back, kick, and punt returner. Te'o clearly had some very monumental and memorable moments, leading that goal line stand against Stanford to preserve the undefeated season. The interception of Landry Jones and the upset of Oklahoma on that Saturday night game called by Brent Musburger and Kirk Herbstreit. But Te'o has done a lot of damage to his brand with this off-the-field incident surrounding his fake girlfriend. Manti Te'o, to me, was a guy that had top 10 ability because of what he did on the field. Te'o was a tremendous player, a very short tackler, a linebacker that could run in space and cover tight ends and running backs coming out of the backfield. He was an emotional leader of the defense, an inspirational story for college football fans and his teammates. All of that has been diminished and in some cases ruined by this story. I find it will be very difficult for Manti Te'o to be drafted in the top 10 where many thought before this news broke he would be, for two reasons. First, Notre Dame was drummed in the BCS National Championship game by Alabama. Te'o also did not play well. The front seven of the Irish was gashed by the offensive line and running backs of Alabama. Eddie Lacy, the running back of Alabama, was able to run wild on the Fighting Irish. There was no push up front by Notre Dame. Manti Te'o, uncharacteristically, missed two or three tackles he normally makes. No problem. That is damaging enough when the lights are brightest, the moment is biggest, and you do not make the plays that were required of you to be the leader and focal point of a great defense. The second part of the equation that has hurt Manti Te'o has been the off-the-field hoax. Similar to Dez Bryant, when he was coming out of college as a star wide receiver with top 10 player potential out of Oklahoma State, Bryant struggled at the combine in the interview process. The most notable situation was with the Miami Dolphins, a team whose GM, Jeff Ireland, at the time questioned Dez Bryant about his past, his mother. Ireland famously asked Dez Bryant, "Is your mom a prostitute?" Which we can argue all day is a fair or unfair question, but the fact of the matter remains. Dez Bryant's handling of that situation, understandably so, hurt his draft stock. Bryant was not a top 10 player selected. He was drafted in the 20s, pick number 21, by the Dallas Cowboys. Now, you could argue that has helped Dez Bryant, having some pressure relieved off of him. Talented wide receivers in the form of Miles Austin, tight end Jason Witten, and a quarterback who can deliver the ball accurately and efficiently most of the time in Tony Romo. Manti Te'o should look at what happened to Dez Bryant and try to stay positive in the sense that falling may ultimately help him. I believe Manti Te'o would be a great fit for a 4-3 team, a team that has four defensive linemen, three linebackers. At Notre Dame, they ran a 3-4, so clearly Te'o can do both. In the 20s, there are a lot of quality teams. I look at the Chicago Bears, maybe looking for the replacement to Brian Urlacher at 20 as a possible destination. I think late in the second half of the draft, the Pittsburgh Steelers might be an interesting option for Te'o. The damage that has been done to Manti Te'o's brand is unquantifiable until draft day. Regardless of the hoax or the truth behind that, Manti Te'o should look at this situation and do what he has always done in every situation. He should try to do the best he can on the field and let the chips fall where they may. Another troubled linebacker, Arizona State University's middle linebacker Vontaze Burfict, who had tons of on-the-field problems between late hits, personal fouls, off-the-field issues, arguing with head coach at the time, Dennis Erickson. He was so toxic in the ASU locker room, reportedly, his teammates did not want him back, so he declared for the draft. Burfict did not get it, the importance of the combine, the importance of the pro day. He had poor workouts, and he did not take the process seriously. I do not think Manti Te'o will do that. The silver lining for Burfict, he signed with the Cincinnati Bengals and made a push for Defensive Rookie of the Year with his play in the middle of that defense. Manti Te'o, if he recovers correctly, may find himself in a similar situation. A situation in which he can come up from the ruins that he has made for himself and maybe let some people, or make some people, forget about the mistakes he has made in his personal life.
Into fourth down now, the head coach of the New York Jets, Rex Ryan, claims he has a blank slate, a clean record, an untouched canvas in his continued tenure as the head coach of the New York Jets.
Ryan obviously does not. Rex, in his first two seasons as the New York Jets head coach, did a tremendous coaching job. He took the New York Jets to the AFC Championship game back-to-back years, the first year losing to the Indianapolis Colts and Peyton Manning in Indy, the second year losing to the Pittsburgh Steelers in Pittsburgh, but still a remarkable coaching job by Ryan his first two seasons, taking the Jets to places they have not been since Vinny Testaverde was the quarterback of the Jets under Bill Parcells, in which they lost in the AFC Championship game to the Denver Broncos, and previous to that, Joe Namath. Since Ryan's first two seasons, the Jets have been nothing short of a disappointment. The Jets two seasons ago went 8-8. We all remember the New York Jets collapse at the end of the regular season. Of course, final regular season game, a game in which the Jets needed to win to get into the playoffs. There was that feud between Mark Sanchez, franchise quarterback at the time, and star wide receiver Santonio Holmes. Both Holmes and Sanchez not talking to each other, which does pose a problem for a quarterback and wide receiver when they are not talking to each other at all. The Dolphins were able to beat the Jets. The Jets did not go to the playoffs. That season, Rex Ryan, just as he had done the previous two seasons, guaranteed a Super Bowl for the New York Jets. Not only did the Jets not win the Super Bowl, they did not even get into the tournament, into the playoffs, to even compete for a championship. This past season, Ryan did not promise or guarantee a Super Bowl for New York Jet fans. This season was filled with quarterback drama between starter Mark Sanchez, Tim Tebow, brought in from Denver, Greg McElroy, the quarterback from Alabama. The Jets unable to get a quarterback, sustain anything on offense, ultimately leading to the firing of general manager Mike Tannenbaum, offensive coordinator Tony Sparano, but not head coach Rex Ryan, not the chief architect of the team. Owner Woody Johnson was quoted as saying, "Rex Ryan is the perfect fit for the New York Jets." The Jets went 6-10 this season and were an absolute abomination of a team. They were an embarrassment for their fans and for those that follow them in the league. The Jets could not figure out that Mark Sanchez was not the answer at quarterback. They brought in the league's most polarizing player, Tim Tebow, to be a personal punt protector on special teams, to run the Wildcat, which he is clearly not suited to do. Unlike Ronnie Brown, the running back in Miami, which Tony Sparano started the Wildcat with, when the Eagles ran it with Michael Vick, Tim Tebow is not a speed rusher. He is a powerful rusher. He is a guy that that would be perfect to run the zone read option, the kind of option run by Russell Wilson of the Seattle Seahawks and Colin Kaepernick of the San Francisco 49ers. Consistent decisions, smart plays, move the chains. Get into the game. That's what Tim Tebow needed to do. The Jets did not do that. The defense eroded. The special teams were porous. The roster does not have that much talent. To be fair, injuries did play a role. Darrell Revis, known as Revis Island for being the best cornerback in the league, injured. But that is not an excuse for the Jets to have played so poorly on offense. Yes, they did lose Santonio Holmes, and they were without tight end Dustin Keller for a majority of the season. But the Jets were an embarrassment. They were the epitome of that same old Jets phrase that Jet fans have heard for years. Now, I am not as successful financially as Woody Johnson has been in his life. But here's what I do know, that apparently Mr. Johnson does not. The New York Jets, under Rex Ryan's leadership, will continue to be exactly what Rex Ryan is. Absolutely mediocre. And an absolute embarrassment for the organization. That's on the field that Rex Ryan has contributed to. When you hire a head coach, essentially they are the face of your franchise. Rex Ryan, as the face of the New York Jets franchise, has been equal parts a joke off the field. Throughout Ryan's career or tenure as Jets head coach, Rex Ryan has flipped off fans at an MMA event. Now, he is a public citizen. He has all the constitutional rights guaranteed to him, just as any other American. But when you are the face of the New York Jets, you cannot be seen flipping off fans at a mixed martial arts event. He was caught on camera cursing at Jet fans walking into the tunnel. Of course, there was that video with him and his wife. That's their private life. But when it becomes public, it reflects poorly on the Jets. And then the kicker, the cherry on top, Rex Ryan spotted with a tattoo of his wife wearing nothing but a New York Jets jersey with the number 6, Mark Sanchez's jersey, on his bicep. How in the world could you have an open quarterback competition when you have the starting quarterback's number tattooed on your bicep? All in all, the New York Jets have shown that their mediocrity and their circus was not only a result of Rex Ryan, but of their owner, Woody Johnson.
Into fifth down now. I'd like to take another moment to thank ESPN.com Notre Dame blogger Matt Fortuna or Arizona State Senior Associate Athletic Director for spending a few moments of their time with us. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can tweet me at FifthDownMike. You can also email the show, FifthDownCFB@gmail.com. You can find the show on iTunes by searching for the Fifth Down Podcast or searching my name, Michael Fiala. Thanks for downloading us.